Welcome back, Left Reckoners. David here, joined by Matt. How's it going, brother?
It's going well, David. Good to be with you.
Well, we're really excited to be talking about the topic today. We're going to be talking about drugs in America, and we are joined by Benjamin Fong, who is the Associate Director of the Center for Work and Democracy at Arizona State University, and the author of this new book that's coming out right now called Quick Fixes, from Verso and Jacobin Press. You definitely grab yourself a copy. There'll be links below for how to find it. But Ben, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I mean, this book is, I really have enjoyed reading through it. And, it's a great take on drugs in America and the history, and also like the class and political dimensions of that, which I think oftentimes are understated and also breaks away from, I don't know, some of the tropes you hear a lot from people who like want to see different drug policy in the US. Anyways, I think it's a really great, revisit of this topic. And I want to talk a little bit about the history and some drugs and stuff like that more in depth in a moment. But maybe just because this is Left Reckoning and something we talk about a lot, I was wondering if, to start us off, if you could sort of talk about the relationship between drugs and labor, in the sense of like drugs and work and how they're sort of thought about both in contemporary times, but also like throughout U.S. history.
Sure. Well, the point of departure for the book is that Americans are today in the 21st century, more generally, consuming a world historic amount of psychoactive drugs. The numbers are pretty impressive. The trends are pretty impressive. And at the same time, of course, we've got this paradox where we have this great appetite for drugs while also having a tremendous number of people in prison for nonviolent drug offenses. So the United States uniquely loves drugs and we also hate them. And it's kind of been that way for over a century. And in the book, I kind of chart the different histories of different psychoactive drugs and American sort of paradoxical love affair with and demonization of psychoactive drugs. And part of the argument, which I think we'll get into in more in just a second, is that it's the unique sort of structure of American capitalism that I want to say is behind those curious facts about the United States. And today, it's kind of difficult not to see drug consumption trends as somehow matching the curious moment we're in, where everyone seems stressed out and freaked out by the present. But I want to say that it's deeper than that, that it's not just sort of cultural and political polarization that's driving people to sort of turn to different pharmacological crutches, but that it's something about the nature of work, about labor, when it's unchecked in a capitalist society. So around the turn of the century, so late 19th century, early 20th century, there were powerful workers' movements in Europe. And it's no coincidence that while they did have temperance movements and some countries moved to brief periods of prohibition, there was nothing like the American obsession with drugs, right? There was no 13-year sort of period of prohibition. The United States at this time also really kicked off global drug prohibition, prohibition in narcotics, cocaine, and opium. The United States was uniquely obsessed with that. And I want to say in the alcohol chapter in the introduction of the book that that's tied to the fact that there was no countervailing political force in the United States to challenge the rule of the capitalist class. And so as a result, you have, extremely stressful working conditions and urban living conditions that drove people to just consume a lot of both alcohol and psychoactive drugs more generally. And so something had to be done, right? There was this this progressive obsession with profligate male drinking and different immigrant subcultures using drugs and whatnot. And so at the same time, you see this explosion of drug use, you also see a desire to clamp it down. And I want to say that that's all, a result of the fact, in short, that there is no actual political countervailing force to industrial capitalism. And as a result, reformers naturally invested themselves in predominantly moral solutions to the problems of capitalism. And that took the form of, paternalistically telling people that they couldn't drink anymore.
Yeah. And you make a point later in the book, the significance of stress And, you know, just comment on that, because I think you make a lot of, you know, there's a points historically that you mentioned, but just that, like, if you wanted people not to take drugs at any point in history, like, stress would be something you would alleviate.
Yeah, if you didn't want to take, if you didn't want people to take drugs in a harmful form, I would say, because there have been moments, where, drug use is regularized. It's part of everyday life, where the kinds of imperatives of capitalist society were not present. So it's not exactly that it's only when we get capitalism that we get this magnificent drug use. It's rather that in a capitalist society where work has particular particular features, not only its regularity, but its length, the speed up, the stress involved. I want to say in the introduction that people in those conditions use drugs more regularly and for specific instrumental purposes. So it's really uppers and downers. You're either trying to get up for the day or you're trying to relax in the brief moments of leisure time so that you can return to work, you know, sparkling and fresh for the next day. And that's a pretty unique situation. If you think about the long span of human drug use, that's not what human beings have used drugs for in, you know, all of history. Human beings have used drugs to get new experiences, for religious and spiritual purposes, for communal fellowship. There's all sorts of ways in which drugs have been used. And the very instrumental and regularized forms of drug use in capitalist society, that's really the focus of the book. I mean, some people who've read it say that I take kind of a negative view of drug use, and it's the complete opposite. It's not drugs that are the problem. It's drug use within the constraints of capitalism that I'm looking at.
You know, and like you can see it in the sense of, like, you know, it's a little juvenile, but like it's something we've covered a little bit on the show. It's like some of these, like, manosphere, the kind of TikTok guys, like how to be a man, how to make $1 million. You know, one of the guys, Andrew Tate, like one of his big things is how much coffee he drinks and how many cigars he smokes, and basically how that gives him the veracity and the power to basically become a killer, you know, as a guy was. And, like, you know, it's just like an interesting way that, like, I think a lot of people think about, you know, even things like nicotine or caffeine, you know, as like performance and enhancing drugs to sort of labor or work for someone else, or to rule over someone else in the Tate, you know, perspective.
Yeah, I'm surprised he's not into psychedelics, actually. And I think psychedelics is like a really good example of this, how drugs that don't really fit the traditional categories of like upper or downer and have traditionally been used, you know, to explore the reaches of human consciousness. Today, they're being microdosed in order to, you know, for Silicon Valley tech executives to, you know, go to their parties. And, you know, essentially to replace the old SSRIs in psychiatry. So they're like, even the psychedelics have been like brutally instrumentalized today.
Mm-hmm. Well, sorry, Matt.
Well, yeah. Well, I don't know if you want to depart now a little bit into specific drugs, but I do want to talk, Benjamin, about coffee. And, you know, there's a lot to be said about like the place of it. Just one, you know, we have Starbucks unionization across the country. Your point in the book where Howard Schultz literally acknowledges the role of Starbucks as a third place, which is like a place outside the home. And it's like, by the way, a place you have to spend money to use the bathroom. But the history of like the coffee house was something I was aware of as a college student working at a coffee shop and thinking, oh yeah, this is like what the Enlightenment was. Can you just talk about coffee as, like, you know, something people take to get up in the morning to serve a boss?
Yeah, the most annoying CEOs are all amateur sociologists. Coffee's a fairly unique drug. I start the book with it. It's you know, the second most traded commodity in the world after crude oil. It is fairly unique, I want to say. I mean, you could maybe include tea and other caffeinated products in this category, but it's fairly unique in having never been demonized by the capitalist class, right? Every other kind of psychoactive drug, they've taken aim at some point in history or another. Coffee has almost universally been seen as something that is a great benefit to life. And I think the explanation for that is pretty simple. Two cups gives you a jolt in the morning to get through the day, no matter what comes at you. And, you know, despite the recurring, social media stories you'll see about the detrimental effects of coffee or whatnot, it's a fairly harmless drug, right? You can take it and it does sort of like mess with you a little bit. But you can take it with no serious health consequences. And so in that sense, it's really kind of a dream drug. And, there have been various experiments to replace coffee with other things. Certainly the military has invested a lot in developing different kinds of stimulants that will keep people awake and sort of jolt them to action at the right moments. But coffee still sort of, you know, uniquely stands on its own, because it's just very efficient at what it does.
Well, I mean, before we sort of jump into, you know, more of these specific drugs and things, could you sort of, you outlined this in the introduction, but like you argue that there's basically four major phases in drug policy and drug taking in this country: the temperance movement in like the late 19th century, the Fordist-Keynesian epoch, the neoliberal reorganization, and today. I mean, could you sort of outline those for our audience, sort of how these ways of thinking about drugs, taking them, and policy around them have sort of developed in American history?
Yeah, sure. So I sort of see these four phases as cycling in and out of demonization and normalization. So at the end of the 19th century, you get the takeoff of national temperance movements. That's also the time, as I said before, when global drug prohibition really sort of kicks off. Mm-hmm. And the United States really uniquely pulls it off. I mean, Americans have always deeply loved alcohol, and it should be a really striking fact that for 13 years, you could not drink it in this country. Yeah. It testifies to a certain kind of moral enthusiasm. And then, you know, when prohibition broke, 1933, we got the New Deal. The New Deal actually delivered on many of the promises that temperance reformers had made. They had thought that they were going to wipe out all the social ills of capitalism. Of course, you can't do that through strictly moral means. And so the political project, the New Deal, actually delivered on a lot of that stuff. And the new consumer society that followed was pretty hostile to the kind of moral paternalism that temperance reformers took up. And so we weren't going to go back to that. In the absence of that project, you got the normalization of all sorts of drugs, not just coffee and cigarettes, both of which sort of reached their highs in the post-war period. I think both sort of peaked in the United States in terms of consumption in the 50s. But you also got the normalization of amphetamines, barbiturates, benzodiazepines, a whole range of drugs that were basically like adult candy, you know, like they were freely available in the post-war period. Sometimes you needed a prescription for them, but sometimes not. I mean, One fact I offer in the amphetamines chapter is that you could buy methamphetamine inhalers over the counter until 1965. And inhalers aren't what they aren't today what they used to be. So the old inhaler, I have some pictures of them in the book as well. The old inhalers, it was just a cotton filler that they'd soak in a drug and they'd put in a little tube, right? When you wanted like a dose of the drug, you'd pop the cap off, you'd take a sniff, you'd put the cap back on. Unsurprisingly, it didn't take some industrious teenagers very long to figure out that you could take out the cotton filler and, you know, swallow it or soak in a beverage and get like a much stronger high. And these were all, you know, medically pure drugs by today's standards. Just a wide range of drugs that were really easily available. And in the book, I want to say that, you know, one of the reasons for this is that while the period was affluent, breaking the back of left-wing politics and trade unionism in America meant that there was no real control asserted at work, right? So you got to buy a house and a car and have a family, but you weren't necessarily able to exercise control over your workplace. You're sort of inserted into a more impersonal bureaucracy. And as a result, you know, things are pretty good. You don't have that much control. So what do? You want kinds of drugs that help you adapt to your circumstances. Things seem materially very good, even though you're lacking that kind of control. And so the wide range of drugs that were available before this period, I want to say, were primarily for adapting to the circumstances. And you know, you get that sense from the pharmaceutical advertising of the time that everyone was like, hey, this society's pretty good, right? It's pretty good. We don't want to go back to the Depression, certainly. We're very happy with having all of these material things around us. So why am I so anxious? Like, why am I depressed? And the drugs were there to help with that. The third phase in the story is coincides with neoliberalism, essentially. And it's no coincidence, I want to say, that the acute phase of the war on drugs really kicks off in the early 70s, as well as the Controlled Substances Act, which created the modern scheduling system for drugs that we still have. And that was a period where all of the things that had been allowed to happen in the post-war period, that's when the crackdown sort of happened on those. So that means illegal drugs. So LSD and marijuana were the sort of, you know, leading drugs of the counterculture. And so obviously Nixon and company wanted to crack down on those. But it also meant crackdown on illicit drugs as well. So amphetamines, barbiturates, benzodiazepines, these were all scheduled. And illicit drug consumption actually goes down considerably with the start of the war on drugs. So you look at benzodiazepine, amphetamine consumption, all that goes down. And so the post-war party goes away, but with one very important exception, cocaine sort of fills the void very quickly. And cocaine was around in the late 19th century, early 20th century, but it had more or less disappeared from the United States for like 30 or 40 years, right? There was a early 20th century cocaine scare, and it just kind of went away. There were laws around sort of cocaine consumption and distribution, and so that was one of the reasons, but it just wasn't part of the culture. And so when it started pouring in from Colombia, Americans were pretty unfamiliar with cocaine, and they just started using it a lot, in part because all these other drugs were now unavailable. And cocaine is kind of the drug of the neoliberal period. You know, it's an ephemeral jolt of confidence. It sort of makes sense, even if it didn't start neoliberalism, it rhymes with it very well. And it was, you know, very accepted in the 60s and 70s. And then, of course, in the 80s, you get the crack scare. I think most of your listeners are probably familiar with the fact that crack is basically cocaine, that it's just baking soda added to powdered cocaine to make it into rock cocaine. The differences between them pharmacologically are almost nil, but very different cultural associations surrounded the two. And it was in response to the crack scare in the 80s that we got a lot of punitive drug legislation, the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, the 1988 version, the sort of first Bush's war on drugs. And so that was a period of demonization. And then to close out, I want to say we're in a fourth period where, again, things are being normalized. We are seeing a legalization movement in psychedelics. You know, I think that a lot of drugs that not that long ago people were pretty scared of are now entering the realm of normalization. And, you know, it's also the period when neoliberalism is falling apart and we're kind of wondering what next. I try not to make predictions in the book because we don't know where this thing's headed. The one thing I will say, though, is that it does seem like the psychedelics market is going to blow up pretty soon. We're on the way to legalization of MDMA, psilocybin, LSD. And when that happens, you know, I don't doubt that the profession of psychiatry will be rejuvenated in various ways, but not always ways that are in the interest of mental health.
I can't wait to be tripping on some Peter Thiel branded LSD. I think
that's synthetic psilocybin. Yeah. He's very aggressively cornering the market in synthetic psilocybin right now. His Compass Pathways.
Go ahead, David.
No, I was just going to say, you know, this sort of gets us, you know, to one aspect that I appreciated in your book. You know, which is talking a little bit about the economics of like the drugs, you know, the drug market. And like one that I think, you know, you covered really well was nicotine and tobacco, you know, wherein most people sort of view what happened, for example, the cigarette companies with like disdain, right? They lied to us. It causes cancer, etc. But you make this point and sort of highlight it in the book. This like, yes, that's true, right? But this is also how business functions, right? And there's this substitution that happens where it's like there's something as if there's something uniquely evil about the tobacco industry, when in fact this is just sort of capitalist businesses operating, you know, as they typically do.
Yeah, in both the cases of the licit drug market and the illicit drug market, I want to say that drug producers and distributors are kind of operating according to basic, you know, laws of that you can learn in business school. There is insidious stuff that happens in the legal realm. Part of that is the fact that they're selling psychoactive drugs, which are both very, very powerful and very addictive. And so something in the nature of the substance itself has to do with the absurd profit margins they can get. But really, if you look at the sort of their typical practices, it's what any business does. It's just the fact that they sell drugs that is the problem. In the illegal realm, it's very similar. You know, you get a lot of you know, media portrayals of the illegal drug trade are predictably gruesome. There's a lot of popular television shows on the illegal drug trade, and you sort of get a romanticized picture of it there. But really, you know, a lot of these guys are just doing the same things that their legal counterparts are doing. Like Pablo Escobar, the guy who's sort of like most associated with violence in the drug trade, like his big innovation was creating this insurance scheme that protected cocaine shipments, like going out of Colombia. Like it's like not very glamorous stuff. And the violence that does exist in the drug trade, it's really, it kind of like obeys market principles, right? Like when you engage in exercises of like really intimidating violence, part of that is like just like human capital development, right? You're like building your brand within a specific like niche market. So in all these ways, I want to say the drug trade, it's not that different from, you know, how capitalism operates more generally. But we do like to think of it as some special case. And in fact, it's like a really, I would say it's like a helpful projection, a helpful way in which we can project our anxieties about the functioning of normal society onto this thing that we think of as wholly other from what we're involved in.
Yeah, you make the point on that about crack too, and like as the post-civil rights failures of neoliberalism become clear as like, oh, communities that don't have opportunities, don't like have been completely underinvested in, like it's not a surprise that something like this would take hold so deeply there. And like, we don't, instead of like addressing that, it's sort of like, ooh, what's in this special compound, or what's in the people themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there have been reporters that you know, that went into sort of like crack neighborhoods in the 80s and 90s, and were like, look, like it's not the drug that people are saying it is, right? This whole body orgasm thing, it's pretty good, but like, let's not exaggerate. And they were also like, you know, if you've only got you know, bad things on the horizon, like crack can make a kind of like sixth sense to you, right? That it does offer a kind of like comfort in degraded conditions. But more generally, what I want to say is that crack really filled the void, the economic void in a lot of these neighborhoods. So it wasn't just that certain urban areas became centers of crack use. They really became centers of crack economies. And they was filling in where there should have been a jobs program, essentially, right? Like where that stuff is lacking, it sort of made sense to be involved in the drug trade. You know, there's this famous advertisement from McDonald's in the 90s, like featuring this young boy named Calvin. Like he's walking through his neighborhood, like he's sort of like avoiding his friends, and the whole time there are these voiceovers like, oh, Calvin's really cleaned himself up, right? Like he's on a good path now. And at the end of the commercial, they show him like put on a McDonald's hat and like sort of smile and say, hey, welcome to McDonald's. McDonald's at the time was paying $3 an hour. Right. Like it's no surprise that was not the kind of glowing option that McDonald's portrayed it as, and that a lot of young people got involved in the drug trade. It's filling in where or, you know, legitimate economic activity should be.
In a minute, Actually, let's do the drug war first. Then we can talk about pharmaceuticals like today. But I mean, could you talk about, you know, the kind of launch of the drug war, both in the way that it was sort of maybe presented to the public, and also sort of like the actual just sort of base political reasons for why, again, like certain drugs were targeted over others, and what the kind of political goal of Nixon and the people who followed him were in sort of criminalizing certain kinds of drug use?
Yeah, there's a famous quote from, I think it's John Ehrlichman, one of Nixon's deputies, where he basically says, look, we wanted to, our political enemies were the New Left and Black people. And so what did we want to do? We wanted to marginalize them. You can't make it illegal to be a leftist or to be Black. And so what can you do instead? You can target different kinds of behaviors that you associate with those groups and then demonize them that way. It's a remarkably bold statement in one sense, but I think it's kind of telling us what we already know, which is that when people vilify drugs, they're not really vilifying the drugs themselves. They're vilifying the things that they associate with those drugs and the people they associate with those drugs. And at the onset of the war on drugs, you know, there were a lot of different concerns, actually, right? It wasn't just targeting one group of people. This was when Vietnam vets were coming back to the States, a lot of whom were using opium and heroin. And there were legitimate fears that, you know, all these servicemen were going to return and bring a whole drug scourge with them. And so there was that. There was, a lot of articles about the pharmaceutical industry at the time and the egregious profits they were making, but also their sort of like lax regulatory structures. There was real fear around amphetamines and benzodiazepine use, right? So long as housewives could take it in the early 50s and stay peppy and thin, it was fine. But by the 60s, there were real fears that people were misusing these drugs. There were a lot of different things that the initial phases of the war on drugs wanted to control. But what I emphasize in the book is that it was just that. It was other things that they wanted to control. There are a variety of social ills that people wanted to get a handle on, and drug policy was a convenient sort of means of doing so.
I mean, it's like similar to policing in general too, right? Like you have a big social problem. With like poverty
it's wild
country
how...
and the cops, yeah.
Oh, sorry, Dave. I thought you were done.
No, I mean, jump in, Matt. You're ready.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, it's wild how frequently there are these sort of secondary, oh, it's really about that. Like, I didn't realize Prohibition was coming after German breweries. Talk about that a little bit, and like sort of like politics and the inability for that to become a sort of like class political moment. It became more of a look at the scary Germans with their big breweries.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just that, but it was the Germans and their big scary breweries as well. The German brewers were very efficient industrialists. They took advantage of rail to increase their distribution. They vertically integrated their operations with saloons, so the kind of like brew pub that's common today, where you actually get stuff brewed in the place where you drink it. That was also kind of an invention of the time. And a lot of the big names are still with us, like Miller, Schlitz, Busch, like all these big breweries started in the late 19th century. And so, you know, at the onset of the war, it was pretty hard for them to maintain their lobbying power, right? It was pretty easy for temperance forces to vilify them. But, you know, there are a lot of other things that like happened at the time as well. I mean, the American Medical Association decided in the 1910s that alcohol no longer had legitimate medical use. This is something that's often forgotten. The doctors in the late 19th century, they often turned to alcohol. It's a regular feature in the history of drugs. They make you feel better. And so the overlap there with medical uses is kind of unsurprising. But in the 1910s, the AMA decided that it was no longer an acceptable medical substance. You know, the 16th Amendment allowed the state to collect taxes in a way that had been previously like dependent upon taxes on alcohol. So a lot of things sort of like happened at that particular moment that allowed prohibition to sort of go through. And there are a lot of contingent factors there. But still, I want to say, you know, like why did temperance and prohibition have the kind of moral force in the United States and fairly uniquely? Well, it's difficult to like look at that, you know, in the face of the fact that Americans have traditionally loved alcohol. It's hard to look at that and not see something about the social conditions in the United States at the time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, talking about that, I mean, one thing that I think is sort of interesting, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on, is like we have seen this pretty dramatic shift in like the way that marijuana is portrayed, thought about, and obviously with like legalization for both medical and recreational use. I mean, you know, how do you sort of square that in the sense of like, you know, both on the, like the political side and the business side, right? Like there's less need right now to go after hippies, right, for smoking marijuana. Is that the major shift, or is the demographics that have been smoking changing? I'm curious to hear, you know, your sort of thoughts on why that has opened up so much in recent years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the imperatives of the war on drugs since the 70s are sort of no longer in place, insofar as the coordinates of neoliberalism are sort of breaking down, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of traditional ideological justifications, they're no longer there. And so there's less of a need to sort of like police people's behaviors and people in the same kind of way. That being said, you know, it's this very odd moment where there are these legalization movements and things are being normalized in a certain sense, but we still have just an abominable number of people in prison for non-violent drug offenses. And so it shouldn't be overstated, right, that like the contradiction is palpable and that it works for certain political interests, right, that they don't have any interest in resolving it. And so there's a lot of talk about you know, marijuana legalization and the Democrats. It seems like an obvious issue that they should just capitalize on. And it's one of those things that could be done through executive order. In other words, it doesn't need to go through Congress. Like at any point, Joe Biden could sit down and sign one document and marijuana would be legal federally. It's that simple. But they don't do it because the contradiction works for them, right? Like they're happy to sort of signal in the right direction. But if they actually legalized marijuana, if they actually you know, followed through on the consequences of that and actually let people out of prison for nonviolent drug offenses who are there, it, you know, the political backlash from the Republicans is just not worth it in their political calculations. And so, you know, they're happy with that contradiction, that to let it be legal in most states but illegal federally, and a massive mess in terms of mass incarceration.
And I was just saying, like, you know, cynically, politically too, it's like a really great carrot to have in states that are sure, like controlled by Republicans, right? It's like, it's a good reason to maybe get interested here in Texas to back, you know, the Democratic Party, because maybe they can get, you know, citywide level decriminalization or something like that. It's also interesting. I heard this from a friend who works on The Ledge, and so I, you know, take it with a grain of salt, but one of the reasons that they were citing as to why marijuana like decriminalization or legalization of Texas is probably far ways away here is because it makes so much money in West Texas, where a lot of people drive through, for very underfunded county and sheriffs, because like they can find people, get some money for it. They don't get much money from the state. It's a big money maker for them. And just the way that the political map is here, they're a very powerful lobby. Despite how popular it might be with like the general population, even the people living in that part of the state, right? There still are a lot of like reverse incentives for prohibition.
Yeah. Can you talk about the international, sorry, you can respond to that, but also the international role. Cause I've wondered, like, are we doing this because there's allies that are really into fighting the drug war still? And you know, we've also exported that to some extent, to just not to over egg the question too much. But.
Yeah. I mean, just briefly on the previous point, I mean, another thing I wanted to say was that, you know, we're at a moment where there is a dearth of private investment in a lot of sort of like needed things. And a lot of the sources of profitability are sort of privatizing public assets, public businesses. And it, you can sort of see it, see what's happening with drugs as an extension of that, right? You're taking, you're bringing something that had previously been out of the realm of profit making into it to allow people to like have some source of profitability, in the same way that you can sort of see that happening with the privatization of state function. And so it, there's a certain sick economic sense to what's going on as well. It's just sort of, you know, like very, very basic economic processes at work. On the international scene, so in, you know, the United States really did lead the effort in global drug prohibition. As you can imagine, drugs were enormously profitable to a wide range of interests in the world in the late 19th century, growing it, trading it, advertising it. There was a lot of money to be made. The United States had a huge patent medicine industry. And in patent medicines, there were, you know, opium, cocaine, alcohol, like all the good stuff. And so it was just an enormously profitable trade. And so you might say, like, well, how did someone come along and say this stuff needs to be banned? Mm-hmm. And I think that at first it really was an extension of the kind of moral paternalism of the temperance movement, that there were, you know, predominantly, you know, Protestant men who wanted to bring civilization to the world, and they thought that they could. And it does seem very odd at the time, but like Charles Brent, who was a main driver of prohibition, he was the U.S. representative to the early international drug control conferences. He was a priest, and so saw his role in predominantly moral terms. Right? He has this famous line that I used as a subtitle for the fourth chapter. He said that his whole purpose was to bring civilization to the Orient. That was his goal. And so I think that early drug prohibition really emerges out of that impulse. By the end of the Second World War, however, in the second phase outlined in the book, there were different things at stake. And I think that the war really proved to the United States that control over international drug flows was very important, And in its quest to become the global hegemon, controlling those flows was of central importance. And so Harry Anslinger, who returns again and again in the book, he was the chief of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics from 1930 to 1962. He made it his priority to make sure that any drug flows around the world, both illegal and legal, were controlled by the Americans. So it was very much a sort of state building exercise. Like why does the United States have this uniquely profitable pharmaceutical industry? Well, it's because we took control of all the drug trades around the world in the post-war period. There's a great book by historian Susanna Rice, and it's about this period. It's about Anslinger and the control of international drug flows after the Second World War, and it's just called "We Sell Drugs." It's a very good title.
That's great. There's a couple more things I was hoping to get to, if we're okay on time. One, I mean, just while we're sort of like on the drug war and like the carceral state, first thing I wanted to sort of ask you was if you could sort of help people wrap their heads around like drug addiction, right? Because, you know, that is an issue that, like, you know, I've known many people who I love dearly, you know, really suffer through and even pass away from. You know, could you sort of frame, you know, like the issue, the social issue of addiction, like historically and within capitalism? Because as we said at the opening, like a lot of these drugs have been used throughout history. I mean, you know, what like kind of social policies and lack of social policies might lead to addiction? How should we sort of think about drugs maybe in a society where we had a little bit more leeway in designing social policy in the US?
Yeah, I mean, the last part of that question gets into more complicated territory than just addiction, because one unfortunate facet of drug discourse is that the addiction and drug registers tend to get confused, right? And so drug discourse tends to be about addiction discourse. When I think most people know, you know, if you ask, I think, most people about their drug experiences, you're going to get predominantly positive stories, right? On the whole. That's not to say that like drugs aren't a real problem for a lot of people. It's just to say that we shouldn't confuse those two registers. And when it comes to creating drug policy, it shouldn't just be addiction policy. On the question about addiction, so I think that one thing that has been very clear in the history of trying to treat addiction is that you can't intimidate addicts out of their addiction. It just doesn't work. And so the project of prohibition has been just enormously regressive in that sense and many other senses. But on that particular point, even Richard Nixon, Nixon was the first person to legalize opiate consumption in America in the form of methadone clinics. And even he saw that it was going to be impossible to use the typical rhetoric and just sort of beef up on policing to get addicts to just stop using. It just doesn't work that way. What has worked is a combination of sort of more controversial things. A lot of it is just sort of basic, meeting basic material needs, right? Housing, healthcare, et cetera. But part of what's really helped traditionally is different maintenance medications. So there's been a curious attachment to methadone in particular as a maintenance medication for opiate addicts in particular. And I think that part of that is because methadone doesn't get you high in the exact kind of ways that heroin or morphine does. And so, you know, even drug Puritans can sort of see some use in it. At least they're not getting high is the logic. But there are a lot of places where, you know, morphine, heroin are distributed as maintenance medications. In Canada, for instance, there are these opiate vending machines. They're not vending machines. They're vending machines, but you have to get, you know, you have to get a certain ID and you have to be registered and, you know, they monitor your use and whatnot. But it's basically allows people to go, you know, dial up the amount of morphine that they want, get it in, you know, medically pure form. Like they're able to take it like with the safe route of administration. And all of the perverse things that happen as a result of drug prohibition, right? Like dirty needles, et cetera, all that stuff goes away. But what they've also found is that people tend to level off over time. Like not everyone's going to quit right away, but at first people get access to opiates and they, you know, they go, you know, they have more than usual, let's say. But then they even off, right? The whole point is not that they're going to naturally overdose when given access to these drugs, is that they're going to find some point where they can take it, they can go to work, right? They don't have to worry about like getting it after work. They don't have to worry about the different things they might have to do to acquire the drug. And so as a result, they can just sort of resume their normal lives. And opiates in particular are drugs that you can take over long periods of time without severe medical issues following it from it. William Burroughs miraculously like lived to his 80s or something, and he took heroin his entire life. Other drugs, not so much. Methamphetamine is not something that should be used long term. It does have disastrous consequences. But with opiates, you know, it's the kind of thing where maintenance medications do work. And in the conclusion of the book, to get to sort of the more policy question, I do touch on a few of the things that liberal drug reformers really hammer on, you know, affordable drug treatment services, affordable and, you know, good drug treatment services. There are a lot of sketchy services out there. You know, different police reforms, legalizing marijuana. There's a lot of like very obvious stuff that the left could pursue, provided that, you know, these reforms maintain some degree of majoritarian support. But at the end of the day, a lot of the things that we consider to be specifically drug problems have to do with problems in the broader society. And, you know, to go back to what we said before with that Ehrlichman quote, it's pretty clear that when people are trying to control drugs, they're trying to control other things about the society. And so when we tackle the problem of drugs, we always have to keep that in mind, that it's the broader problems of society that are being attacked. And so when we come up with solutions for them, we have to think about it in that capacious sense. And so I sort of close the book by saying, there's really two things that could address a lot of different facets about what people are concerned about with psychoactive drugs. And that's jobs and healthcare. You provide people with good jobs, you provide people with decent, affordable healthcare. A lot of the things that we associate with pernicious drug use are going to go away.
So one of the things I wanted to touch on you on with you on before we close is how maybe people who are anti-capitalist or socialist should think about, drugs that are used right now in a clinical setting to treat mental health issues, right? Anxiety, depression, etc. Because there's a lot of different strains of thoughts on the left. It can get very controversial, the way that we talk about them. And I'm just curious, like somebody who I know like is very interested in these subjects in general, and also wrote a book on drug, the history of drugs in the US. I mean, could you talk a little bit about how maybe we should orient ourselves and think about these things? Because obviously it's like, you know, important treatment for a lot of people. It's also a very large industry. And, you know, the water gets very muddied on this conversation. So I'd be curious if you could give us a bit of clarity, if possible.
Yeah, I mean, I would say a lot depends on which mental illness we're talking about and which drugs we're talking about. I'm sort of working my way into your question, but I think that part of what's controversial about the whole field is that some people would want to say that contemporary forms of mental illness are reflections of capitalist society in some sense. And so, you're treating something that is historically specific and not necessarily biologically rooted. And other people want to say that, like, no, this is something that is not about capitalism. This is something that we should think of as not in not in terms of capitalism or anti-capitalism. There's like a weird there's a gray area there that a lot of people get very heated about. And again, I think we need to get more specific about the kind of conversation we're having. But I mean, let me just take one example. Because we're going through an amphetamine shortage today with ADHD. I've seen and heard a lot of callousness towards people who are suffering through the moment, and just, you know, there's no need for that ever, of course. But you know, the replies are oftentimes like, you know, kind of reductive and supportive of pharmaceutical ad company, ad copy when it comes to like the definitions of the disease. And I would just say, like, you know, we have to look at these things historically. That's part of why I wrote the book. The category of ADHD has not always existed in its current form. Amphetamine use has not always existed in its current form. There's a long history to these things. And we can see these categories as absolutely real and absolutely things that people suffer from, while also injecting some historical consciousness as to like how these things came to be and how we came to treat them in this particular way. So I understand that that's not very helpful in terms of the sort of like broader question, but it's a difficult one. You know, I mean, I would say in general, people's experience should not be dismissed. There's no reason for that. At the same time, it can't be the only thing guiding policy and positions, that that there are broader historical factors at work in both drug use and mental illness, and shutting out that conversation doesn't help either.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult, I think, to disentangle these things. But for example, when you see like the Department of Education tweeting out, you know, suicide hotlines when this Supreme Court decision came out too, it's like recognizing that, being able to recognize that it's like there's a lot of bad actors out there too, right? Both like there are pharmaceutical industries that sort of want certain results. There's also people who I think are just very quick and willing to sort of dismiss
you know, people's individual experiences and cases, because they want to sort of uphold a grand theory of everything as well.
Right. No grand theories. That should be the conclusion. We don't need grand theories anymore. We've done it. We don't need it anymore.
Yeah. Well, Benjamin, I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about this book. It's a really great read, folks. It's drugs. It's fun. It's fun to read about. Quick Fixes. It's up from Verso. We'll put a link below for people to find it. Thank you so much again.
Yep. Thanks for having me.